Washing Tech.
Hey, it's Joe, and I don't have to tell you, relationships are critical in Washington. But how do you A, find out who the key players are, and B, figure out how to reach out to them? Well, I want to tell you about Leadership Connect. It's been an absolute lifesaver for us as we expand our operations and outreach here at Washing Tech. Leadership Connect, it's the digital service used by top federal contractors and government affairs leaders to contact decision makers and develop those strategic relationships. Visit leadershipconnect.io and join the community. I love it, and I'm 100% sure you will too. That's leadershipconnect.io. Try it now.
Normally, physicians would meet someone, they would have an initial conversation. That person probably has a chronic illness and they have months or even years to talk about what kind of treatment they're going to have. But during COVID, the doctors were meeting people who had been completely healthy before the pandemic, may not have discussed their end-of-life plans with their families, and then were showing up in the ER, may already be intubated. And so the doctors are racing to try and work with families to figure out who these patients are as people and like what gave them joy in life, what kind of care would be appropriate for them.
Welcome to the Washing Tech Policy Podcast.
From Washington, D.C.
with Joe Miller.
Joe Miller.
John Lewis. Wow. Elijah Cummings, now we've lost John Lewis. It's our turn, folks. Civil rights movement seemed so far removed when we were growing up, didn't it? Because the pictures were in black and white, we felt like it was ancient history. At least I did, I don't know about you. It's only now that we realize how much we're connected to the past. And if you think about it, we only want to connect to previous generations when it makes us feel good, right? We want to hide the other stuff. E.B. White once wrote about a lake he'd visited often as a boy, and then much later with his son, and talked about how the lake was the same as it was. The grasshoppers, the boat, the trees, the wind, all the same many years later. Walt Whitman, in Crossing Brooklyn Ferry from Leaves of Grass, spoke to us. He, as he looked across the shore, watched the boats going by and imagined how we too could look out and marvel. And he talked about it giving a sense of connectedness between his generation and our own. Not so with civil rights. In mainstream society, in any case, which is what most of us primarily participate in. Listening to John Lewis's March on Washington speech, he said, "There's nothing to protect the young children and old women who must face police dogs and fire hoses in the South while they engage in peaceful demonstration." So I thought Lafayette Square, or what's happening in Portland. Quote, "The voting section of this bill, referring to the Civil Rights Bill, will not help the thousands of black people who want to vote. We still see voter suppression, still see the Trump administration slowing down mail delivery, allegedly. Cutting the post office budget so people can't receive mail-in ballots." He said, "We need a bill," not Trump, obviously, John Lewis, "that will ensure the equality of a maid who earns $5 a week in a home of a family whose total income is $100,000 a year." Same thing happening today. Maybe it's not $5, maybe it's $100, but it's the same thing. We can imagine being connected with Walt Whitman, but not with essential workers. Not with black and white photographs. I can just imagine folks sitting on watching Brooklyn Ferry right now, walking their dog, getting a latte, working from home, because there's a conformity that's required in a meritocracy. It's not created. This meritocracy has created such stark inequality. Broadband access, for example. 9 million kids don't have it. So what's going to happen? Are they going to lose everything they learn? Richer kids are getting 2 or 3 grade levels ahead because their parents have so much more time on their hands. But we don't think about equality in the same way we think about rivers and lakes. monster in the closet. The hidden staircase for slaves in the plantation house. The exposed brick wall in the renovated Harlem brownstone isn't there to reflect on the people who came before the people who live there now. It's there because it looks pretty cool, right? Sarah Harrison keeps it real. She's a freelance writer and journalist based in New York. Previously, she was a reporting fellow at Wired, former assistant editor for the politics section of Los Angeles Review of Books, and her work has been featured in outlets including Wired, Protocol, San Francisco Magazine, Carleton, and Berkeley alum. At Berkeley, she was a Dean's Merit Fellow and won the Clay Felker Award for Excellence in Narrative Writing. We need more writers. Sarah Harrison. So tell us a bit about your background and the topics you enjoy writing about.
So I don't actually have a tech or a science background at all. I was actually an English major in college, but I do think science is totally fascinating. And one of my big priorities in my reporting is to try and translate highly scientific topics for a non-science audience. So one topic that I really love to write about is our sense of smell, which is totally strange. It's actually pretty poorly understood and hard to replicate in technologies like robots. And it's highly technical. There are lots of complicated molecular reactions going on, but it's also very relatable because most people have a sense of smell and they can experiment on some of the concepts in themselves. So it feels more immediate than just something happening in a lab.
And your work attracted my attention because, you know, you wrote an excellent Wired article on telehealth and palliative care. So I wanted to have you on the show to discuss, and I assume many of our listeners know what palliative care is, but perhaps there are some young people out there listening who aren't quite sure. So let's start there. What is palliative care exactly?
Yes, I've also found that palliative care is less commonly known than other specialties, and it is somewhat different from other medical specialties. One of the doctors I spoke to describes it as treating the lived experience of a serious illness. So while other doctors are mostly focused on treating a disease, either by operating or by having some sort of focused treatment, aggressive treatment, palliative care physicians consider how to alleviate the emotional and physical suffering that comes with treatment. So instead of just trying to cure people, they try to make the patient's life enjoyable or at the very least comfortable while they're sick. And palliative care is also very collaborative, and the teams can consist of therapists and doctors and nurses, but also chaplains who will all work together and with the patient to figure out what kind of treatment is acceptable for them. So are they okay with a feeding tube or a breathing tube? Or what about life support? They'll have conversations about what they want their quality of life to be and at what point they're going to have a life they don't want to live anymore and when they're ready to start dying, essentially. So that can look very different for different kinds of patients. Some people need a medical intervention, and other people need more spiritual support as they come to terms with their own mortality.
And your article looks specifically at palliative care in New York City. How did the COVID-19 outbreak affect providers there?
It affected them quite a lot. During the pandemic in New York, at the height of the pandemic, so end of March, beginning of April, palliative care physicians at multiple hospitals were overwhelmed with requests for consults. I know that at one hospital, they had a 7-fold increase in requests. At Mount Sinai, they actually set up a 24-hour call line so that doctors in the emergency room and in the ICU could call the line and get connected with a specialist. And both these hospitals had to enlist doctors from across the country to meet their demand. And it was also a unique kind of palliative care, because normally physicians would meet someone, they would have an initial conversation, that person probably has a chronic illness and they have months or even years to talk about what kind of treatment they're gonna have. But during COVID, the doctors were meeting people who had been completely healthy before the pandemic, may not have discussed their end of life plans with their families, and then were showing up in the ER, may already be intubated. And so the doctors are racing to try and work with families to figure out who these patients are as people and like what gave them joy in life, what kind of care would be appropriate for them.
I'm joined by Sarah Harrison, a New York freelance journalist whose recent article in Wired about palliative care and telehealth garnered a lot of attention here in the States. We'll take a break here, but when we come back, we'll take a look at how technology and telehealth can address some of the challenges we're seeing here, as it seems sky's the limit, I suppose, for new COVID-19 cases. Stay with us. Back with journalist Sarah Harrison. We're looking at palliative care providers' ramp up of telehealth options to treat patients, an issue she wrote about in a fascinating Wired article we've linked to in the show notes. How prepared was the medical community to respond with remote-based palliative care alternatives?
Well, remote palliative care wasn't new. Some providers have already been using it for years, especially to reach people who live in rural areas and can't come into a doctor's office easily. These are patients who typically are extremely weak, so getting into a car, driving for several hours possibly, and then getting into the doctor's office can be a big ordeal. So they had already started using telemedicine as a strategy for handling that. But like almost every other telemedicine specialty, the pandemic just really exploded and sped up adoption rates. So one provider I spoke to that treats patients in Kentucky and Indiana, for example, had piloted a telehealth option. They were really intrigued, but now that the pandemic is here, they are treating all their patients in this way. And it's also sped up adoption amongst doctors who may not have ever tried it before, and then they do try it and they're very excited about the possibilities. And similarly with patients, some had been really resistant in the past and they would say, no, we want to come into the office. But now that they're finally forced to try it, they find that they like it quite a bit better and they realize they can get great care this way. So I think, you know, the systems already existed, but now adoption is sped up quite a bit.
This is especially important given the aging, the graying of America, an important area of healthcare and so dependent on empathy and being present with patients. How have providers been responding to now having to rely so extensively on telehealth?
I think it's mixed. Overall, the providers are very positive, especially when it comes to having empathic conversations with their patients. They say they can have great conversations, that they're faster and more efficient because it's much easier to just say, okay, we're done, and hang up on a Zoom call than to politely extricate yourself when you've come to visit someone in their home. They also don't have to worry about driving. Driving between patients in rural areas can take a lot of time, so this allows them to do things much faster. And even the doctors in New York who were in the hospital, they had really positive reactions because they could include more family members in these conversations, people who live all across the country or the world, and that they could have these really joyful, big family reunions even in the ICU. But it's not the same. You know, you can't use nonverbal cues like hand-holding or hugging to telegraph that you care about the patient. And so doctors are trying to figure out new ways to create those trusting and empathic relationships. Several doctors told me that they use storytelling to show that, you know, they really care about the patient and to gain information from them. But some doctors say they still prefer, especially for a first visit, for someone to come in or for them to meet in person. And then, of course, the one major unresolved issue with all telemedicine is that you can't give a physical exam, and that's a big limitation.
Yeah, it's sad to think about people reaching the end of life and not having the support system in place to help them transition peacefully. Obviously, to your point, something in a best case scenario, all Americans should have access to. So final thoughts, what do you want people to take away from this conversation and how can they reach out?
I think the biggest takeaway is that it's never too early to start thinking about advanced care planning and to talk to your family members about it. I know that talking about death with your parents or with your partners or your siblings, family members can be incredibly awkward and it's not the first conversation that you want to have. But it is really important to start thinking about what quality of life you want, what gives your life meaning and joy, what kind of care are you okay with? And to start having that conversation, even if your choices change and evolve over time, it's just important to start and to start thinking about it yourself.
New York City award-winning freelance journalist with bylines in Wired, of course, The Markup, San Francisco Magazine, and others. Sarah Harrison, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much, Joe.
And that concludes episode 238 of the podcast. Thanks so much for listening. If you like what we do, we'd love to hear from you. Please leave a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. Helps others know what they can expect from the show and really helps us out. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you back here next week. Take care.
Washing Tech.